Today, I'm going to give an introduction to my guest, Natalia Mota, because it's a little bit different than some of the interviews we've done previously. If we put on our website, I'm going to interview a computational psychiatrist. Not many people are going to click and watch this, but I think it's fascinating in a historical as well as the clinical perspective. You know, I have a degree in mathematics, so if you say computational, I'm interested. But I know that's not everybody's interest. But in terms of history, in 1954, Paul Meehl wrote a book called Clinical versus Statistical Prediction. And in that book, which caused a sensation, he was making the claim that many aspects of clinical psychology can be improved by making statistical predictions. At that time, it wasn't AI. It was simple, ordinary least squares regression. But he showed that you could make these predictions. Now, just to tell you a story, because, you know, at a certain point in life, we like to tell stories. I was invited to Austin Riggs Hospital in Massachusetts to give a lecture. And one of the other guests at the lecture series was Daniel Kahneman. So I said yes, because I got a chance to have dinner, talk with, and interact with Danny, as we call him, Danny Kahneman. And it was fascinating. So he's giving his presentation to the staff at Austin Riggs. And the reason they invited him, by the way, is he did an internship there with David Rappaport, who was a famous psychoanalytic clinician and theoretician. So one of the questioners brought up, well, what about this statistical versus clinical prediction? And because Rappaport was a big opponent of Paul Meehl, they were waiting for some kind of argument here. So Kahneman explains that if you're predicting something long-term, like clinical outcome or progress, then statistical prediction is very good, much better than clinical judgment. If you're trying to predict or determine what's the next response you want to make in the immediate clinical interaction, yeah, then clinical judgment. So I just remember some guy in the audience raised his hand and said, well, no. Clinical judgment's superior. I can know what's going to happen with this client in the first 30 minutes that I'm talking to her. Kahneman says, so you think clinical judgment is superior? He goes, yes, clinical judgment is superior. Well, Kahneman said, how confident are you in that estimation, the clinical judgment? Oh, the guy slams his desk and says, I'm very confident. And Kahneman said, well, I won the Nobel Prize for showing that confidence and accuracy are inversely related. So I thought, you're not going to argue with a Nobel Prize winner. The prediction of various aspects of human function in a statistical means is very important. So what Natalia is doing is analyzing the speech of humans and making important determinations. In particular, she's able to take the client's narrative of emotional topics and make the prediction of whether this person who's at risk for some kind of psychotic disorder, schizophrenia, and do it very accurately from the speech long before the disorder develops. And it's so interesting that first she's able to do this, but it has clinical implication because it helps teach us how to listen to aspects of the parents, of the patient's narrative that we might not otherwise attend to. And so for that reason, I think this is so interesting and clinically important. So only one other thing before we get to the interview, and I ask Natalia in the interview about this. This is not the use of AI. You know, the problem with AI is, yeah, we could probably teach a machine to do this, but we're not going to understand the mechanism. What is being detected here? So I think this is a fascinating and clinically relevant work that Natalia's doing. So I hope you'll enjoy the interview as much as I did. So let's get to it.
Today's podcast is brought to you by CarePath EHR. Research shows that therapists can get better outcomes today through measurement-based care. And with CarePath, that's never been easier. Head over to carepath.com now to learn more about how we can help you to make your therapy better.
Well, Natalia, I'm excited to talk to you today. You're a computational psychiatrist. With my background in mathematics, I'm quite interested in what you're doing. But let's start right at the beginning and ask you, what is a computational psychiatrist? Many of our audience won't be familiar with what a computational psychiatrist does and what the focus is. So just tell us a little bit about what you do, what computational psychiatry is as a field, and then we'll delve into what you do particularly.
Okay. So computational psychiatry, it's known as the field that uses computational algorithms to understand the phenomenon of mental disorders. So using computational strategies to learn or to model diseases in terms of neuronal mechanisms, but also using computational algorithms to calculate or put some metrics on what we call symptoms. So nowadays we have a large variety of different strategies on the field of natural language processing, that it's from the computational side. It's not specifically for mental health. It's a field that emerges to understand how we can create algorithms that understand natural language from humans to translate those patterns to machines. And we were we could get it in a sense of specificity that we nowadays have, like the generative artificial intelligence that can generate language that seems just like another human talking. It says to us how we could be very successful on creating those algorithms that resemble us of what is to talk with someone, what is to generate narratives with someone. The idea of the computational psychiatry in that sense of using natural language processing to understand symptoms is in terms of using those strategies to capture signs of what is divergent in the language from someone that expressing a kind of symptom that the psychiatrist or the psychologist could sense while they are listening to their patients. So what I made as a contribution was to, in the first beginning, so this term of computational psychiatry emerged in around the 2014 in some reviews. And my first paper was from 2012. So I was not in the field was not there yet, at least as far as I know. I don't know if there was some publication before. But what I did was I was aware of some of those strategies from collaborations that we had in our institutions with the IBM. So my former supervisor had connections in the IBM, and they were looking for natural language processing tools to understand problems in the industry. It was in the time that we had like different web searches like Yahoo, Bing. It was not, everything was not Google, you know? So in that, they were using natural language processing tools to understand better what people were trying to search in the web. And in that sense, we started to think that, wow, those strategies can capture some subtle signs of human language. And that's exactly what I was learning as a psychiatrist in the residency program, listening to my patients and studying psychopathology. But when I tried to go to semantics and start to create large corpuses in Portuguese, I faced a huge challenge to have to program by myself as a medical student, and then I started to study other strategies. So looking at the math. Per se, one thing that colored my attention that time was that some symptoms about the formal thought disorders that calls the attention of the form of the thought sequence. So those symptoms resemble us in the descriptions that in a way. The sequence of your thoughts is mirrored in your narrative as the sequence of your words and what you are talking and associating in sequence. So when you have like disorders, we call it like schizophrenia, you can have symptoms that you have some fragmentations of those thoughts and thoughts trajectories that you can feel it and you can listen it as a fragmented narrative or impoverished narrative. It's like other symptoms that I thought that it's very interesting is the derailment. So you have the sense that you're gonna follow in a trail and you get out of this trail. So different symptoms calls the attention for the word trajectory. And as a psychiatrist, you train your ears to have a sensitive listening to that topology. So what I thought, so let's design this topology using math and using graph theory in a way that you can represent each word as a node, as a unit. And the sequence of words is designed by directed edges or arrows that tracks this trajectory. And every time that you repeat a word, you close the cycle. So you can close a cycle that it's very small, like repeating the same word associations, or you can form like different size cycles that glue together in one very large connected components, for example. And that's what I thought. If we can listen to a fragmented speech, when we put this as a graph, when we represent this narrative as a graph, we should be able to calculate how fragmented it is or how complex it is, looking at connectedness, for example. So that's when I started.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fascinating because I realized in your response that really quantifying what clinicians sense or think about verbalizations. So it's good when we think of these as thought disorders because we listen to the speech and we make clinical judgments about that speech.
Exactly.
And make inferences. And what you've done is to formally and mathematically analyze the speech graphs in a way that quantifies that kind of clinical impression.
Okay.
So that's fascinating. So let's get into a few of the studies, and then we'll talk about some more general issues. But basically, again, you're analyzing these speech graphs, the nodes and the edges, and quantifying different aspects of this. So in one study, you asked participants with psychotic features to verbalize a recent dream. So they're talking about these dreams. And then you analyze the speech graphs, and you're trying to differentiate those who develop schizophrenia from those who have some psychotic features from mania. Yeah. So borderline or patients with borderline disorder. So tell us about what you did and what you found and how you were able to differentiate the speech patterns of the patients with schizophrenia from those with bipolar.
Okay, great. So when I was collecting this data, actually, I was collecting with very severe patients that were hospitalized in clinics in Brazil. And sometimes the assistant doctors were divergent about the diagnosis. So that's why I collected both. Everybody that was expressing psychotic symptoms, and I wanted to study everyone that was expressing hallucinations and delusions. And one thing that I noticed from psychopathology that was very different from bipolar disorders, from schizophrenia, was this patterns of symptoms of formal thought disorders. So bipolar patients tended to produce a lot of words and to have tangentiality and flight of thoughts, that it's very different from impoverished speech or fragmented speech that we can listen to someone that is suffering from schizophrenia. Also expressing hallucinations and delusions, but expressing themselves in a very different way.
And again, you're not asking about their clinical symptoms. You're asking them to recount a recent dream.
Yeah.
So it's in the basic speech between two
exactly
humans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have a fun story about this research question, because I was a psychiatrist I was a resident, actually, when I was collecting the data. And in my time, people were neglecting a lot psychoanalysis and all this stuff. I loved psychoanalysis, but it was not in the fashion in that time. Actually, neuroscience was not the fans of dream research and all this stuff. but I was in a dream lab. So the lab that I was studying, my former supervisor was a specialist on dreams and memories. So he was interested on dreams. And I was more or less like skeptical when we first collected the dreams. Okay, that it's nice. We can analyze this. And we analyzed it. The first paper of 2012 was I created the whole methodology, designing the graphs by hand to calculate and to automatize the process. So that it was very fortunate decision to look at dreams reports, because dream reports show it the differences between the groups, but not the daily reports. And I just asked this question about dreams versus daily reports in the second paper when I automatized the process. Because I thought that as a psychiatrist, I had this intuition that when the patient expressed their differences in their symptoms, it's expressed in all over the narrative. The impoverishment, it's all over the narrative. Yes, it is. But when a healthy person or a bipolar patient express a daily report, they tend to express it in a very regular way and also impoverished, because it's not an interesting narrative. At least I interpret it like that, you know? So when I look at the difference of both questions, I was kind of shocked. And my supervisor at this time was like, I gotcha, you know, dreams are cool. Okay, you have a point on this.
So the daily narrative didn't reveal the richness in the differences that the dream report did. And yeah, because we kind of have rules for how we talk about daily events. This happened and then this happened. Whereas when you talk about a dream, the usual rules of conversation are a little bit different. It's emotional. It doesn't happen necessarily in a sequential fashion. And it sounds like just kind of a accidental finding. Your advisor was interested in dreams. You know, by the way, when we publish the podcast, I'm going to attach some of your graphs, because I think if you see the graphs, you really get a sense of it.
Correct.
Exactly.
Yeah. In the 2014 paper, we have an example that it's very impressive in the differences of the groups. But in the 2017, it was when I turned to the early psychosis. So I thought for the application side, it would be interesting to apply this to have some predictions and early predictions of that psychotic symptoms could turn on schizophrenia disorders, for example. And when we are talking on this diagnosis, we have to mention that the late diagnosis leads to untreated disease that could have a lot of bad consequences for the patient. So when some teenager is expressing delusions and hallucinations, it can evolve to a cyclical crisis that swings with the mood, or it could be just one episode per se. It could be something related to drugs or intoxications, but it could also be the first episode of schizophrenia disorder, for example. And in the sense, in this first sentence, you had to rehabilitate the patient. You can make your best efforts to keep them studying, to keep them having social environments, to keep having friends. And I thought this could be interesting to have a tool that could advise in the first beginning and not having to wait months or 2 years, that it's the middle that we have to close the diagnosis. So,
clinically, and we'll get into this maybe in more detail, but it's really important that early on we can make an assessment of whether this is developmentally becoming a sign of schizophrenia, or it's a result of this manic aspects of bipolar. So clinically, if we can intervene early, and we'll talk about early intervention as we go on. But I want to come back to how the speech graphs, and actually the speech patterns, are different even at this early first episode of some kind of psychotic feature.
So when in that paper, I collected different kinds of narratives, but the emotional cues were the thing that differentiated the groups. When you talk about a recent dream, or when you are seeing affective features with negative emotions or positive emotions as cues, and you have to create a story based on that picture, your graph narrative represented as a graph, you produce graphs with low connectedness related to compared to those ones that would 6 months later express not schizophrenia disorder, but bipolar disorder. So what we did, we collected in the first consultation when the patient was seeking for help for the first time. And we follow this first episode patients for at least 6 months, each one. And we compared those narratives with also matched controls. What we found is that using that first consultation narratives, when using the dream report narratives or the emotional features narratives, we could differentiate those that with more than 90% accuracy. So using area under the rock curve, the results were very high. And because we have a very high sensibility and specificity to differentiate those that would 6 months later receive the diagnosis of bipolar disorder from those that would receive the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Because when you can listen to something and calls you an attention, when you put metrics on this, you get precision. So adding math to this clinical formalization, that's why it's so powerful, because it works. Because you put, it's like you can be a very good dermatologist and look at the skin and look to our skin thing. But when you have a microscope, and you can figure it out, the very thin details on that skin problem, you have more precision on that phenomenon, and you can predict what is the prognosis of that phenomenon, looking at patterns and studying large populations. So that's the thing here. When you add math to have a precise description, what is a fragmented speech, you can add a lot of precision on that prognosis, on that, in that sense. So that's why it evolved in the field in this way. So afterwards, it was replicated in different languages, in different sites, and also related to some biomarkers as well.
Fascinating. But the critical aspect of the discussion seems to be around verbalizations of emotional material, either elicited through reports of dreams or of emotional stimuli.
Yes.
So it's the discussion or the verbalizations around these emotional issues that differentiates. And as you say, it's pretty impressive that you can take a relatively short verbalization, represented as a graph with these nodes and edges, and then analyze it in a way that is highly accurate prediction of the development of two different disorders.
Yeah, because it was not a strategy that was designed for other things. It was a strategy that was designed thinking on the psychopathology. That's why it mimics the psychopathology. It's different from like using generative AI to nowadays trying to predict something like a black box, you know? It's not like that. It's thinking on the phenomena per se. That gives us this path that I think it's very important for the field nowadays, is to have interpretability of what we are measuring. So the combination of the speech elicitation protocol and the natural language processing tools that you're using to analyze that verbal response, it's very important to you to interpret it, the results that things out from there, you know, and it has to be linked to what we know as symptoms nowadays.
Oh, you raise a really important point. I don't want to skip over, but this is very different, what you're doing in this analysis of the speech graphs, than just submitting the verbalization to a AI machine and saying, what are the differences between these two speech patterns of those who develop schizophrenia and those who develop bipolar. So say a little more about that, because I think, you know, AI is on everybody's mind, and they think we can just use this tool to make predictions like this. But what you're doing is very different. I think it's worth having a little more in-depth discussion of the differences between the computational psychiatry work you're doing and AI.
Okay. The main stuff here, Bruce, is that when you put your data to be trained and to obliquely be classified as having or not having a disorder, you can be capturing some subtle signs of psychopathology that it expressed on the language. But you can also have some signs of social factors that is actually going together with the condition of having a mental disorder. One of that aspect is education, for example. We have and social status. So when we are talking about severe mental disorder, we are talking about individuals, groups of individuals, families that express some patterns and behaviors that are not so well adjusted in society and have these gaps of having success in their lives and to achieve higher levels of education or higher levels of professions. So this could be very important confound factors that you are introducing in your machine algorithm and not acknowledging. And those strategies could be capturing more signs of those social factors than from the psychopathology per se. That's why I was very afraid to have this kind of mistake from around 2015. So I started another field of my career, and I started to study cognitive development. What I was worried about is that, okay, I could find a way to measure something that is related to symptoms. But actually, this is so new that I don't know how it evolves in a typical child when they are evolving language. Language is not a blood marker, for example, like genetics that keeps it statical in your life, you know? It evolves and it differentiates from a very different factors. So socioeconomic status, age, education, all the stuff matters here. So I started to study how a kid could develop these narratives that becomes more and more connected. And that's when I could find a syntactic curve showing that the main attributes of those rap topological attributes that informs about differences between schizophrenia and healthy controls of bipolar disorder were actually more closely related to formal education than age, actually. So when a kid starts to read and write, it has a kind of revolution in their patterns of narratives. It diminishes the small cycles, the word repetitions, the short-range repetitions. It diminishes very clearly and stably in the first year of education when it starts the reading and writing. But to be able to narrate a story with with a lot of lexical diversity, vocabulary, connecting each different words with each other, this needs a much more investment on formal education and stabilizes only after the high school, actually. The adult pattern, it's only reached out after high school. I live in a country that has a lot of adults that are illiterate. In Brazil, we have in my state that I used to live, in the Northeast Brazil, we have like 15% of the population without access to a formal education, that could not read and write. So when I started to study their narratives from that population, I could find that illiterate adults produces narratives in a very large range of variety, but in the mean, they do not differentiate from preschoolers. But preschoolers and illiterate adults differentiate from literate adults. So we have to be careful about social factors here.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you raised that. It's one of my questions. And reading your papers, you've been very careful about putting in the developmental, the educational, the social and cultural factors, because we want to be careful. We don't want to develop a screening instrument that is biased because someone doesn't have the lexical complexity because they're not literate. So So I thought was one of the interesting findings is how this complexity develops in the normal population versus the schizophrenic population. So taking all those other factors we talked about into account, talk about the developmental pattern of the lexical complexity of schizophrenics versus normals, because I think it's fascinating.
That's the thing. It's very tricky because when we are looking to that population that express psychosis, hallucinations and delusions, we could not find correlations with age or education. What I think is that when you are expressing symptoms that disorganize your thoughts and infect your communication, that it's a very important social strategy that you have, you are not actually getting the advantages that you had when you studied in school or when you were raised in a certain kind of culture. You are expressing yourself more due to your symptoms than due to your historical and cultural context, you know? So symptoms prevail. But not the cultural and the educational aspects of that individual. So that's one thing that we also need to be very careful on predicting basic science when we are studying using those kind of tools, natural language processing tools, because different psychopathologies and different social factors could impact and could be interpreted in different ways, you know? So just the same, we see that when you are not expressing symptoms, what explains better the complexity of your narrative is education. But if you express psychotic symptoms very early on, you started to express yourself not due to your educational patterns, but more due to your symptoms.
Yeah. So the effects of the schizophrenia really kind of truncate the growing complexity that normals would develop over time, and it becomes kind of plateau.
Exactly. More about this fragmentation of thoughts. We had also another line of study studying aging and dementia. And when we look at people that developed Alzheimer's disease, their narratives were also with a low connectedness compared to those that were aging. And when we look at what cognitive aspects explains more this low connectedness, what we found is that during typical aging, what explains more was episodic memory. It was having more details in your memory to narrate that story. But in Alzheimer's disease, the first thing that you lose is episodic memory. So what impacts the more the connectedness in the narratives in the Alzheimer's disease group was semantic memory, was the ability to name things. So different psychopathologies and different states of consciousness, you have to be cautious to interpret those markers that are very unspecific.
Yeah. Well, really interesting when you talk about this, because we think of dementia as interfering with episodic memory. We can't remember things from the past, but you're talking about interference with the semantic part of this, how we describe it. So we're coming towards the end, I want to talk about what I think is one of the more interesting things that you said in one of your articles, because people are going to go away from this thinking, well, this is a pretty good screening device. We know there's difference in kind of the word graphs and how people express themselves with schizophrenia. So this is, it's a good diagnostic tool. But it's more than that. And I want to quote you here because I think this is so fascinating. And you say in your 2025 article, it may be that the increased use of incongruent negative emotional words could impact the social function and contribute to social isolation, loss of opportunities, and even social relationship. So it isn't just that some abnormality creates this verbal pattern, but the verbal pattern then affects the social abilities of the patient, which exacerbate or maybe it's central to the disorder. So say more about this. I think because this is a mechanism that is underappreciated, the social part of it.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that question, because I'm very worried about nowadays this increasing rates of mental disorders coming earlier and earlier in age with our population. So until 2010, we had around prevalence of 10% of young people, adolescents, for example, having some kind of mental disorders. So globally, from 2010 until today, we had like an increase on three times that. So in medium, we have like prevalences nowadays of 30%. And in U.S., for example, when you have a gender differentiation, you can have like almost 50% in the girls expressing some kind of mental disorders. That could not be explained by biological factors, you know. From 2010 from now, you can only explain this with the social changes that we have in facing, mainly in the way that we socialize and we're looking at this vulnerable age group of adolescents. It's the first time that they are actually evolving and manifesting their abilities to understand their emotions and expressing their emotions, but without the full maturation of the prefrontal cortex. So without deeply understand what this means. So this age group is feeling a lot and with a very complex way. And nowadays, they are not socializing with 10, 20, 30 other adolescents in their school. They are socializing with a lot of different people on the internet and social media without any regulation and exposed it to a very different social context as well, without guidance. So what I started to think is that it's not that everything is a disease, but we may be facing a social phenomenon here of what we call it here in Brazil as mental suffering. We use this expression of mental suffering to not pathologize that before we understand what is happening in the context of that individual. But it's like when someone is expressing depressive mood, anxiety, and feeling weird about the environment, this could be some signs of mental suffering that it's actually linked to the context that they are facing. And in that sense, I believe that this kind of phenomenon could be socially contagious, you know? So mm-hmm. when you
yeah, the social contagion is a fascinating phenomenon. Yeah. But we also have, I mean, we've had COVID isolation, and we have increased use of social media. It would really be fascinating to track longitudinally the complexity of graphs, and that, as you say, much of what we might think of as mental disorders is actually suffering from kind of disordered, well, I don't want to say disorder, but maybe a change in the way we socially relate to each other. Because, you know, that's fascinating. I've got lots of ideas we're going to follow up on for studies. I mean, you could look at the density of social media for individuals and the complexity of their narratives around emotional issues. And then when people are actually in a human interaction, they don't have the capacity to really form the human bonds because of this truncated complexity in their understanding and expression of emotions. It's fascinating. I got a whole career laid out here for how we go. It absolutely fascinating. So we're about out of time. This is, you know, we've just scratched the surface of this topic, because it's really amazing. I mean, we started with the complexity of these emotional narratives as a diagnostic assessment, and really got into a discussion of the kind of the intricacies of mental health and healthy functioning that is fascinating. And again, the narratives aren't just simply diagnostics, but they're a kind of a view of these processes that are so critical in healthy development.
Exactly. And just to close, I really believe that we need to think about language not as only a window to the mind, but more than that, it's a way to really work with the social bonds that we have. And we have to understand that when we are adding technology, we cannot neglect the human factor. So I really believe that we need to keep the human in the loop, you know, still giving more power to the human relationships that could be more understandable, and not just to substitute this on technology. It's not about that. It's much more than that, you know? And I do believe that when we are looking at crisis on mental health in such a large scale, we have to avoid the stigmatization of individuals when we are looking to this kind of problems. And we have to think more as epidemiologists, as collective health, you know? We need to care about environment. We need to create well-being in social environment. And that's why I believe that having facing these challenges inside schools is very important. So taking care of school mental environment to keep it safe, to keep it good, to keep it healthy, to keep it truth, you know, it's very important strategy to avoid this mental crisis, just to keep evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful. Well, this has been fascinating. And just again, you know, it's appealing to me because of the mathematical part of it, but it's so rich in understanding mental illness, to be able to identify trajectories of development. It's just fascinating where this is going to go. So thank you. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Feel free to call me anytime you want it. Okay, I love it.
Oh, I have 100 okay. ideas for projects.
Just let me know.
Great. Thank you.
And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.